And good morning and welcome to this August 10th, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm going to give you more information on how to access that later in the show. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. We're doing what we do every single Wednesday morning, which is talk with authors not only about their books, but about their writing process, creativity, craft, all the things that separate those of us who write from those of us who publish. A huge pleasure this morning to welcome one of my short story heroes, Patrick Ryan. And in the second half, Otessa Moshfegh will join me to talk about her novel Eileen, which was just longlisted for the 2016 Man Booker Prize. But first, Patrick. Patrick Ryan is the author of the novel Send Me, as well as three novels for young readers. His work has been published in Granta, Tin House, Crazy Horse, and One Story, and has been anthologized in the Best American Short Stories. He was also a fantastic mentor at my summer One Story Writers Workshop last summer, where he is the editor of One Teen Story. But it's his collection, The Dream Life of Astronauts, published by the Dial Press, which is an imprint of Penguin Random House, that we'll be talking about this morning. He joins me from his home in New York City. Patrick, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank
great
you.
To be here.
Oh, it's great to have you on. I love this book. I just heard this great phrase last month in connection, actually with Jess Walter, but he had been described as a writer of stand-up tragedy. And I think that's a spot-on description of your writing, that you know, it's laugh out loud funny, and the dialogue is, you know, akin to stand-up comedy. And then there's this emotional depth of these stories that you know, just hits you right square in the gut. And you wonder what the heck happened to you.
Well, I'll take that as a compliment. I did a little self-survey, you know, to assess one's own work. I did something like this recently, and where you would list all of your short stories, and then you had to pick these words from a list to describe them, kind of the tone. And the one across the board that kept coming up along with funny was sad.
Yeah.
And I thought,
yeah.
Okay. All of the stories are funny and sad.
That's right. Yeah.
But I think it's better than just funny. And of course, it's better than just sad.
Yeah. Well, you should steal this Jess Walter thing of stand-up tragedy. I think it's...
stand-up tragedy is... Does that mean a stand-up tragedian?
Tragedian. I think that's right.
Yeah, a stand-up tragedian.
So I'm going to give you a chance to kind of take us into the collection and kind of talk about the genesis of some of these stories, kind of the overarching themes, and then, you know, that'll segue into our discussion of the book. Can you kind of take us into the dream life of astronauts?
Yes, gladly. I started working on stories that had similar settings a long time ago, and the setting was the general area where I grew up, which was the Space Coast of Florida, right in the middle of the East Coast, the Cape Canaveral area. And I grew up thinking that it was a really dull place that no one would ever be interested in. And then when I got into an MFA program and started writing stories that had the setting, that was the one common denominator that people had a good response to, was we want to know more about the setting. And so I paid attention to that and then eventually accepted the fact that not only was it pretty interesting to most people, but that I was having a hard time escaping it. Mm-hmm. In terms of, it's just where my brain went creatively when I would think about where to set something. So these stories, about half of them, their original versions were, some of them way back. There's one story in the book that I wrote the first draft of when I was 21. And then just rebuilt from the ground up over and over again over the years. And there's another one that I did a first draft of in graduate school when I was 24,
wow,
I guess. And then about half of the book are from stories that I wrote over the last 5 years.
Which are those? Which is the one that you wrote at 21?
The one that I wrote at 21 is called Summer of 69.
Uh-huh.
And I think that you might be able to tell. I rewrote it and rewrote it. I kept redoing it. But I think that there is something kind of youthful in that story. And then the other one was, it's called The Fall Guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And they come right next to each other in the book.
Yep, yep.
Those were early efforts.
it's really interesting to me that you talk about writing from this landscape of your own childhood, because I talk to so many writers who that is the truth for, and I always think that it's maybe because, you know, there's some sort of pre-verbal stuff going on in your forming of your subconscious that you can't give language to yet. And that's really the fertile ground for writers that they keep going back to and trying to make sense of that age where they were trying to first make sense of the world.
I think that's right. And you also have so much more time as a kid to absorb, just in general, just surroundings and textures, and because you're not working a job and paying bills and worrying about taxes and dying and, you know, all of those things that just come one day and are in your life forever.
Yeah,
for the
right.
rest of your life. Well, you know, you're a little, you never think about it when you're a little kid, but I think that when we're about 5 to 7, we start thinking narratively, even if we don't know what that means.
Yeah, right.
You know, you start being aware of a narrative arc in a situation, you know, along with consequence and you know, action and reaction and all that stuff. And you're just walking around taking it all in.
Yeah. You're being pounded with bedtime stories.
bedtime stories and daytime stories. And, you know, and you get to start picking what you're going to watch on TV and when you want to go outside. And then you can just stand and look at something for an hour. And all of that goes away when you become an adult.
Yeah.
Or for most of us anyway, because it just life becomes something different. And so I kind of wonder if it's a two-part thing for why so many writers write about the landscape where they grew up, even as they go on and on through their adult years. You know, one is that that's where all the wonder took place, but the other was that was really when they had time to drink everything in.
Yeah, that's a really interesting observation, which kind of dovetails on, you know, a lot of these stories are set in the characters are either enduring adolescence or they're enduring old age. Which is the other time of your life when you have a lot of time to sit around and observe what's going on.
I'm right in the middle.
Yeah, right, right.
Barreling away from one and toward the other one.
Well, and it's interesting that you're right in the middle, but you don't really write too many characters about being right in the middle. And, you know, your fascination seems to lie in either coming of age or, you know, or be really old age. And Florida obviously lends itself well to, you know, to the elderly and aging. But I thought there was a lot of compelling stuff in those stories, too, of characters observing the end of life. And I was wondering if it's easier for you to write about characters who are not biographically you, if it's easier to get into the minds that don't resemble yours.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. It could be the truth that their minds all resemble mine when you really pick them apart.
Yeah.
I could see that, but I don't write much at all that's, especially when it comes to fiction, that is has a character that's based on me. In Send Me, my first book, there's a character who is pretty much me when he speaks like me and he talks like me, and some of the things that he does in that book I did, but that I don't even know if I've done that again since.
Mm-hmm.
Really, I'm much more comfortable coming up with, say, like one of the characters in the book who ended up being one of my favorites was this 60-year-old grandmother, and basically looking for love in all the wrong places. You know, trying to get a date, trying to just have some dignity, having gone through 3 marriages. All of that stuff is not in my wheelhouse of experience.
And you write that so well, that story in here.
Thank you. So I have much more fun, and I feel like the end product is much better when I'm sailing off like that, like when I'm getting in somebody else's boat and pushing off into their waters for a while.
Yeah, right.
And not just recycling my own, because I'm not. I mean, writers, we're not that interesting, usually. We don't even have interesting lives, because we just sit around and read our stuff and read other people's stuff and mark things up and wear our eyes out.
Right, right. So mentioning that grandmother story, which is another story, there's a a story in here called Earth Mostly that has a wonderful grandmotherly character who's also kind of looking for love in all the wrong places. And one thing that I noticed about some of the stories in here that I think is interesting and maybe a good tool for writers is this kind of Venn diagram of characters, that the story is often happening, that is told from two different points of view. And these two characters are kind of going on their own path. And then there's this very interesting intersection that kind of happens between them, but not a lot. And it feels like the story takes place largely in that little tiny intersection between them. And I thought Earth Mostly was kind of a good example of that. The Fall Guy was a good example of that. And I was wondering how conscious that is for you when you create a story. I think a lot of early writers say, well, whose story is this? And, you know, why are there, you know, in a short story, you can't do too much. And so why are we talking about two different people? But talk about doing that in a short story, taking two points of view and then letting them just cross a little bit.
It's a great question. And it's something that anytime I've brought up this idea of taking two ideas for stories and trying to turn them into one, whenever I have talked to students about that, the response I get is usually kind of eye-popping, like, oh, you can do that? No, you could do that. I think the first time it ever occurred to me was when I had the story accepted to one story long before I started working there. So that was back in 2004, I think. And Hannah Tinty, the editor, she was the one who, she thankfully took the story before she thought it was done. And then we started talking. We literally got on the phone and started talking. And then I went back to the drawing board some. But she said, you know, you have these two characters, and they're obviously in the same world, but the story is following one of them and then the other one. But at the end, they never come together into a scene, and wouldn't it be nice if they did? Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, that's an interesting idea. So I wrote an entirely new ending for that story. And it was all for the better. I mean, it was brilliant advice she gave me, and I'll always be thankful for that. And so I kind of carried that forward. So what I find, the trick then is that if you're going to set out to do that, the trick is to then not make that be too obvious of a thing that's coming down the road for the reader.
Mm-hmm.
Because I totally agree with you. The real story, you read these two storylines, and the real moment that this has all been working toward, you know, is out right out there, and it's going to have them somehow involve them both. And you don't want these big signposts, you know, like exit signs saying that exit is 2 miles away, that exit is 1 mile away, and here you are.
Right.
Because it's not, you know, you don't want it to feel like a fill in the blank or a paint by numbers or something.
Right, right.
The one challenge I find is if I, there. You can write stories where you don't know what the ending is going to be at all, and then you can write them where you have a vague idea, and then you can write them where you definitely know how they're going to end. And I almost never write with no idea at all, because I'm not good at wandering around in the dark, and I almost always write with that in that middle road, you know, writing just a vague sense that this isn't going to go well. That's usually my starting point for everything. And then how am I going to get there, and just how bad is it going to be, you know, or just how unpleasant is it going to be? But with that story in particular, with this grandmother and this eight-year-old granddaughter, I knew the last lines of dialogue. They never changed from when I started the story. And then because I was working full-time at Granto while I was writing that story, I took 6 months to write it. And because I was working, you know, writing maybe 4 hours a week.
Yeah.
And so the whole time I was thinking, how do I make this not just glaringly obvious that this is where the story is going?
Yeah.
And you never really know until you just finish it, and then you give it to some friends, and people say, I saw that coming a mile off, or, oh, that was really a nice surprise.
Right, right.
Because it's pretty much never up to you after a certain point.
Right. Yeah, as somebody used the phrase, you know, the goal of the short story is surprising inevitability. And
yes, that's good.
And I think that's right. And it's very hard. You know, they said, well, just make it surprisingly inevitable. And I'm like, well, yeah, it sounds so easy. All right.
Done.
But that, yeah.
Where's the macro for that?
Yeah, exactly. Control-Alt-Shift. Oh, it's surprisingly inevitable. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's that is the trick, obviously, of all of these. And I thought, you know, with these two intersecting points of view, that is another thing to put in a writer's toolbox, that, you know, that's another way to approach it, that that you can bring these stories together in a surprisingly inevitable way.
Yeah, it is, because that's a beautiful way to put it, because you do want a reader to not only be satisfied, but to think, and that is really the only way that could have ended.
Exactly, right.
You want it to make the click and make that kind of sense. And of course, there's never just one way to end it, but you want it to be so satisfying that it does seem inevitable.
Endings are so hard in short stories. I mean, I really think that they are one of the hardest parts, because, you know, in a novel, you really want everything tied up in a nice bow, and you want your reader to feel satisfied after 500 pages of, you know, spending 2 weeks with you. And in a short story, you really kind of want to leave the reader a little off kilter and a little curious.
Yeah. And there are little tricks that can sometimes work. One of the things that I play with is, however I've drafted the ending, because I'll write something a little too much, and I'm trying to make a really nice sentence or two that will resonate and blah blah blah, you know, all these nice little things, and then I'll get that on the page, and then sometimes I'll just start almost with like tiny little scissors. I'll just start snipping back and back and back, and one example of that is in that story, Summer of 69, which is set on this orange farm right near the launch facility when the first moon launch is going up in June, or July of 69. And I had this description at the end of that story, and then I think it was my editor who said, well, what if you just dial this back and end on the bug? Because the narrator is observing this bug eating a plant while the rocket's going up. And that was always there, but that wasn't my closing note, you know?
And it was such a resonant note, because she was always so inward looking, and she, you know, she never looked up.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was like a stroke of luck to have those things come together like that. Right. Because she's a character who's just so closed in and afraid to look up, afraid to look out. And just to end, literally end that story on a bug.
Right.
while the rocket is going up, okay, is such a better ending than what I had before, which was a description of the rocket.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it changes the entire tone of the story to end it on the what she was kind of a bug.
Yeah.
That's great. I love this description of writing short stories as kind of a topiary, that you say, you know, you take these little scissors and you just make little cuts. And I think, you know, it is sort of bonsai tree shaping, you know, this whole short story.
It is. Yeah. And you're hoping that it doesn't die while you're so carefully pruning it.
Yeah, right.
I say that from having had a couple of bonsais. You're working away, and then you don't realize that this thing is actually also on its way out.
It's also dying. That's funny. My guest this morning is Patrick Ryan. The book is The Dream Life of Astronauts. If you haven't picked it up this afternoon, is not too soon for you to go do so. It's wonderful. It's funny. Somebody described these stories as all of these characters kind of dying on the launch pad. And you know, as you're mentioning Summer of 69, she was another one. But all of these characters are sort of like the duds on the launch pad. And I hadn't thought of that, but I think that's really true. But yet we root for all of them, and, you know, they're all funny, and they're all like us, and
thank you.
So great. So a lot of these stories have, you know, there's an interconnected quality to them, that certainly they all can be read alone, but then, you know, you also have the pleasure of saying, oh, I know that guy from this story. And I was wondering if that was always there, or if, you know, interconnected stories, interlinked stories sell better, or if you always knew that this guy was going to be in that story, or kind of tell me a little bit about the interconnections.
I don't know if they sell better. I try not to pay any attention to anything that has to do with sales figures and publishing, because it's so far removed from the act of writing. But I know that people like them. People tend to like them, and they sort of walk this fine line between being a regular story collection and a novel. And because I had done my first book as 12 interconnected short stories. That's, I mean, I wrote them to be 12 standalone pieces that then made this portrait of this one family. So I that was when I first started to enjoy that process. And then I also took a couple of characters from that book and put them in this book. And so one of them has two stories, two prominent stories in this book. But what I found in doing that, and the reason I sort of keep getting drawn to it, is if I enjoy a character and then I'm starting a new short story with that same character in a different point of her or his life, it doesn't feel like a constraint. It feels like a point of departure in this really wonderful way. And so there was some moment when I was working on, there's a pregnant teenager in the biggest story in the middle of this book, and she's 16 years old, and she's just trying to figure out what she wants to do, and everybody around her is giving her unsolicited advice. And her mother sort of steps up to the occasion unexpectedly in that story. And so when I finished that, I thought, gosh, I really like this mother character. I'm really interested in her. Maybe I'll write about her later in her life when she's around 60. And then when I was thinking about that, I thought, well, then where's the daughter from the other story now who was pregnant in it? And I thought, well, maybe the daughter is taken off and the grandmother has the baby. And that baby would now be 8. And so I had, so there I'm writing about two characters. I mean, one character in two different short stories, but in one, she's in utero. And in the other one, she's 8 years old.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, this is just fun. This just feels right and fun. And so now, still hanging out there, if I want to, I can write about this, the teenager who took off and what happened to her when she went to California.
Right.
And, you know, and just sort of approach a bigger portrait of these people that way.
You kind of get the benefits of the novel and the benefits of the short story all at once then.
As a writer, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think sort of as a reader, although there was at least one person who read this book really carefully who didn't realize that the grandmother in the one story was the mother from the other story.
Oh, really?
Which didn't bother me at all.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you certainly can read it. You know, you can read all of them independently. It just gives you an added layer of, hey, I know that Moon Rock. Hey, I know that.
Yeah, exactly.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that Moon Rock appears in a couple of other stories that aren't in this book.
It's great.
That didn't get put into this book.
It's a great image. It's a great image.
What?
I thought we could spend our last few minutes talking. You can choose any story that may have vexed you the most, if it's Summer of 69 that you've been working on since you were 21. But I thought it would be interesting to kind of deconstruct whatever story kind of gave you problems and talk about the initial seed of whatever sparked it, and then kind of the evolution of how you worked through it to have it become what it became.
Gladly. Yeah, that would probably be Go Fever, the story called Go Fever.
Uh-huh.
And that was because the experience that I had writing that does not mirror any experience I've had writing a short story, because it was so not the way I work. I wrote a very, very early draft of that in, I guess, the mid-1990s, and published it in a tiny magazine. And then I did this cleanup of it when my editor and I were starting to work on this book, and I showed it to him, and he said, well, there's almost no story here. It's really thin. It's about these two guys. One of them's the narrator, but the narrator himself, he doesn't have any character. Why is that? And I didn't have a good answer. I said, well, I just thought it would be cool that he didn't have a character. You know, I had no good defense for that. And he said, well, the reader's going to want to care about both of these people. And these are two men right in the aftermath of the Challenger disaster.
Uh-huh.
And they both worked on the Challenger. And that was the starting point for the story for me, was just what would it be like to have worked on it and then have that happen 73 seconds after liftoff, and then how does that echo in your life as you go forward, you know, in your days. But I had no real story going on. And my editor came up with the idea to, what if this narrator is having an affair with this other guy's wife, because it was already in the story that the man suspected his wife of fooling around. And the narrator is this guy's confidant, so they're at work, and he's talking about his life all the time and complaining, and he's paranoid. But injecting that late into the process, I say late as in that story had already been floating around in my head for 20 years when this idea came up. And it was just like knocking open all the windows and doors, at all this fresh air. And I thought, oh, okay, now I'm not dreading trying to figure out how to turn this into a decent short story. Now suddenly it's fun again.
I love that. I love that. We all need a good reader.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's it became something entirely different from what it was, because it becomes this story about this rotten guy who's telling the narrator more than his best friend knows, or telling the reader more than his best friend knows. You know, it's a confessional story. He's a somewhat unreliable narrator in a way, because he doesn't come clean with the reader at first, and there are all these things going on in there, and it wouldn't have happened if we hadn't just punched through, you know, just my original very limiting idea.
And I love the idea of how long that this was knocking around your brain for 20 years, and, you know, short stories sometimes take that long.
Yeah, there was one other one in the book that I had written and I put away, you know, on a typewriter, because it was pre-computer days, and then I found the only existing copy of it in an accordion folder, and I thought, oh, I remember this, and I didn't like any of it, and so I wanted to just rewrite it from the ground up, but that story is in the book, and then I found later another sheet of paper that had my submission record, and I had sent that story to 30 different magazines.
Wow!
Back in the mid-90s.
Wow!
And then put it away, and I thought, well, that shows some stick-to-itiveness a little bit, you know,
right?
Stubbornness or something. It shows something.
Well, that's exactly what it takes to be a writer. I mean, I think that more than talent, it takes that stick-to-itiveness is what separates those from do it and those who don't. I also wanted to ask you about how editing impacts your writing, and being an editor and being at Granta and being at One Story. When you have that editorial eye, does that sometimes quash kind of the new ideas coming? You know, how do you turn off the editor to turn on the writer? Because an editor too soon in the process really can kill the writing.
Yeah, and I'm really good at that. Anyway, even before I became an editor, I'll write 10 words and take 5 back. I'll never be the kind of person who spits out a rough first draft and then sits down and works with it. So I work really slowly. When I became an editor, actually, before I found out how it affected my writing, I found out how it affected my reading. That was the biggest challenge for me, is it's really hard when you then sit down to read for pleasure, to read like a person and not be editing or, you know, wanting to change things around.
Right.
Because you've got that rhythm going. But it didn't really... It just made me harder on myself, becoming an editor, because when you work for a magazine... Like Granta or One Story gets 8,000 to 10,000 submissions a year for 12 slots, and so when you're looking at all of these things, you're looking at a whole lot of first and second pages of a whole lot of different stories, and so you start to get this really good sense, at least for your own taste and the taste you hope reflects the magazine you're working for. You get this really sharp sense of what doesn't work as an opening. What's not an effective first sentence? You can't list what not to do necessarily, but you know it when you see it.
Yeah.
Right. So then I carry that, and it's sort of a double-sided coin, or however you would say this, because it's a good thing that it makes me not be okay with a lame first sentence of my own.
Yeah.
Or just an opening that does not draw the reader in. And establish a few things really early on, the who, what, when, where's, you know, the just a nice anchor, something to build on. A first sentence that has absolutely no way to be read with any confusion. These things that sound really basic and no-brainers, they are hard to keep in your head when you write. And so the flip side of it is that I will get extremely hard on myself because I start thinking, that's just not good enough, that's just not good enough. And I won't let myself go with, sometimes you just have to work with some raw material.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think it's made me a little too critical in the moment of my own work.
Well, it worked. Look what you made. Look what you made. It's
thank you.
However you got there, it doesn't matter. It's 9 stunning stories. And I also, you had mentioned the story that you published for One Story So Much for Artemis. I love that story. So also to our listeners,
as you're
seeking Patrick Ryan out, seek out that story. It's incredible as well. I hate to say this, but we've drawn down on our time. Do you have one sentence word of advice that we haven't given out yet?
Oh, yeah. Don't let the bastards get you down. That's my one sentence word of advice, because there's plenty of discouragement to be had out there.
Isn't that true?
And I'm all about hope. I'm all about putting in the hours and having a little bit of hope.
I love it. Patrick Ryan, this was an enormous pleasure. Thanks so much.
Yeah, mine too. Thank you.
We are going to take a very short break, but I will be right back here with you with Otessa Moshfegh in just a few moments. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. You can find us on podcast. We are under iTunes, College Radio, Writers on Writing. You can find us on Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, which is penonfire.com. You can follow us on Facebook. We are on Twitter at KUCI FM. We are on Instagram. We're on Facebook. We're on Tumblr. There is absolutely no excuse not to be tuned in. I am your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Otessa Moshfegh is a frequent contributor to the Paris Review. She has published 6 stories in the journal since 2012. Fence Book published her novella, McGlue, in 2014. She was awarded the Plimpton Prize for her stories in the Paris Review and granted a creative writing fellowship from the National Endowment of the Arts. She's currently a Wallace Stegner Fellowship at Stanford. Her novel, Eileen, was published by Penguin Press in August of 2015 and is now out in paperback. The book was just longlisted for the 2016 Man Booker Prize. And a forthcoming collection of short stories is set to be published in January of 2017. So I'm anxious for that. Otessa, welcome.
Hi.
Hey, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me. And I should actually mention, I'm not a Wallace Stegner Fellow.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's over. Yeah.
Oh, that's over.
The old bio.
Damn. Time passes so fast. You were a Wallace Stegner Fellow. That's perfect.
Yes.
So let's set the stage. I'm going to let you kind of take us into the world of Eileen. This is a character I loved I love dark and disturbing. I love characters who put words to emotions and feelings and amorphous stuff that I have about myself that I'm too scared to do myself. So I identified with her. I thought she was great. And so take us into her world. Take us into the book, into the woman, and kind of how all of this was conceived.
How was the book conceived? Well, Eileen takes place in a small town in New England in the dead of winter. And she's 24 years old, and we're in 1964. So I conceived of this book initially as it was really kind of a character study, and I was curious what would happen if I used what to me feels like a contemporary psychology in a first-person narrative set in a place that's totally repressed.
Uh-huh.
And what would happen if I let that voice tell the truth about what she was thinking and feeling and seeing and her judgments and her anxieties. And I'm from New England. I live in California now, and that's because I cannot handle the winter. It is so oppressive and miserable and scary in many ways. It's also, you know, beautiful and wonderful. But so I escaped that environment. And I thought it's a good place to have somebody crawling out of their skin.
Yeah.
So I take it back to 1964. I put it in a small town outside of Boston. And I conceived of this woman, named her Eileen, and it kind of just went on from there.
It's funny because we were talking in the first half hour, and we talk a lot on this show about setting novels in the places where you grew up. And, you know, I think there is something really compelling about adolescence, coming of age, childhood memories, all of that stuff that a writer's mind returns to again and again. And this is yet another example of that. And I think that environment, A, growing up there, but B, as you mentioned, it's oppressive and it's scary. I love the word scary for the winters there. It's so visceral and evocative. And growing up in that environment as a little kid in those elements, I also would think would be visceral and evocative. And you know, no wonder your mind goes back there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, something about, okay, so I should say, you know, it's 1964, and I was born in 1981. So my imagination of 1964 really comes from, like, what is left from pop culture and literature and film and, I guess, like, the neighbor, like, the old neighbors I grew up next door to in Massachusetts. And my sense of it was that, well, in a small New England town, 1964 was probably more like 1954, in relation to what was happening socially in, like, more progressive parts of the country. And in a place like that, I would imagine that it was not commonplace for people to be expressing, like, the baser human emotions shamelessly.
Yeah.
So when I think about Christmas time in New England, it's like, you know, and you see this a lot in the book, it's like, what is on the surface of things? It's happy families. It's, you know, nice little white children dressed up in sweaters and knit hats and, you know, sleigh bells ringing. And I mean, in the reality, you know, not everybody's life is like that, you know.
Nobody's life
Eileen
is like that.
I'm sorry?
Nobody's life is like that, yeah.
Right. Well, I don't know. I mean, I think there are some deranged people who can probably live a life on the surface like that and maybe never dip into any kind of reality beyond it. But, you know, Eileen is, she doesn't have that kind of candy family. In fact, she has a really disturbed family, a dysfunctional family. Her father is a really bad alcoholic and a retired cop in this town. Her mother probably an alcoholic too, and died when Eileen was just starting college, and she had to drop out because of that. And she has sort of this absent sister who Eileen thinks of as this kind of like freewheeling slut, and that's her own judgment, obviously, for her own reasons, because Eileen has a really strange relationship with herself, and strange in that it is not a kind of cookie cutter pretty picture relationship that we would love to think women find easy to have, even in a culture as violent and misogynistic as we live in today. Like, oh, well, you know, women, we like happy-looking women. We like women who are smiling and pretty. And, you know, when they're angry, they're hysterical. And, you know, Eileen is just, when I thought of Eileen, I was just like, well, I'm just going to go all the way with what it really feels like to be an intelligent woman trapped in a completely idiotic society,
yeah.
You know. And this is not an extreme version, you know. Like, this is the version that I experienced.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are worse places in the world, but this is a specific case, you know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people have reacted to her, you know, in reading reviews and interviews, people are kind of afraid of her. And I take that as a fear of your own self and a fear of your own, you know, I mean, we all have the thoughts she had, or we all do some of the things she did, or, you know, in our, but those are all the things you don't want to admit to. And those are the parts of yourself that you, you know, try to hide, or you hate, or you deny. And you said something in an interview, which I think really hits it on the head, that all of this is kind of getting to the fear of death and getting to the decay of the body and getting to the limitations of the body. And, there are so many things that were well observed in here. It's hard to read at times because it's not just a confronting her. It's confronting yourself and a lot of the things that you don't like about yourself. But I think that's incredibly powerful. I think that's and hard to do. You know, the first thing that so many new writers struggle with, I think, is being honest and being and going deep enough and going to the scary places. And Eileen is such a great example of doing that.
Well, thanks for seeing it that way. I really do appreciate it because I've done a lot of interviews where, you know, it's like, oh, they can't wait to tell me that they thought Eileen was so creepy and strange and they just had never encountered anyone like that. And I'm like, you know, are you seriously? You've never encountered a woman who has negative thoughts, you know? I think about this all the time, obviously, but I think in literature, there is a tendency, and literature is being published now in this kind of commercial way, like literary fiction and commercial fiction. Well, I don't know. Arguably, there's, you know, the, like, romance novels, and that's its own genre that I respect. And then there's literary fiction, but I think the way that we're approaching books right now is so much more about entertainment than their artistic value. And within that sphere of entertainment is, like, what is this book saying socially? As though art now has this moral responsibility to reflect forward thinking in a safe way. And I completely reject that responsibility. I do not think that that is what the purpose of art is. And, you know, don't ask me what the purpose of it is, because it'll take me, like, 3 days to get through a single thought. But given all of that, the way that this book has been approached by the more mainstream media is that it's this dark, grotesque character, you know, because she talks about going to the bathroom, you know?
Right, like, right.
and I haven't, you know, I am not the kind of person to want to make things stupid, you know, or make it easy to brand. And I think part of the, there's, you know, like, you read some reviews of this book and actually haven't read them.
Yeah,
that's
good.
Just like the sense I get from skimming the first paragraph.
Right.
Is that they want to talk about it like this mystery story, you know?
Yeah.
Or like a noir novel. And I think especially the British see it in that genre, but I don't know. I think that they have, like, a more subtle sensibility in general. American sensibility is much more black and white. And then others, I think, just can see it as the kind of satire that it's meant to be.
Right.
And so what I really wanted to do is take this ridiculous precedent for literature about women and push it to an extreme so that it would, you know, the reader could either be horrified or satisfied that somebody had put a real female voice in this kind of narrative. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I think, I think you can almost be both. I mean, I think horrified might not be the right word of what I felt, but I think, I think you can be both. And I think so much of literature, as you observe, is kind of sanitized for our protection. And, And you're right, there is an entertainment quality to it that, that takes a lot of these subjects off the table. And you know, she's just very, I don't know if the word is authentic, but she's very honest about a lot of the emotions and thoughts and feelings that women, particularly women in the 60s, I would imagine, who couldn't express it any other way, must have felt. I can see the noir quality coming through just from the setting. You know, it's a very, you know, if this was to be filmed, it would be all in grays and blacks, it feels like. And so I think there's a tendency to jump to noir to describe. I mean, everybody's trying to fit something into their mental box in their head to make sense of things. So noir, I guess, is a label people could easily slap on it. But you're right. It's got so much more depth. One thing that I wanted to talk to you about before we, I don't want to run out of time before we get to talk about this, because through interview of interview that I've read of you, you have such a delight and love and enthusiasm of writing, that it's just seems like a joy to you. And because our audience is largely writers themselves, and I want to give you a chance to kind of impart some of that love and enthusiasm to people who, to the message that writing is always hard and there's so much writer's block, and it feels like you just get such joy from it. And I was wondering if there's anything you can share to impart some of that enthusiasm to people.
Well, it's nice to be reminded of those moments in interviews where I talked about joy, because the work that I'm doing now, I was just talking to a friend yesterday. I'm coming through a period of total joylessness, what I can say is I love writing in the same way that I love being alive. Sometimes it sucks. Yeah. It feels terrible and I want to die. Sometimes I want to kill, you know, my book, and I don't know. I mean, you know, I made this decision maybe like 5 or 6 years ago to dedicate my life to being a writer and really explore in this life how far I can get and what I can discover about what it means to be creative in this way. And so the part of the joy that I feel is just that I feel like I'm fulfilling my life's purpose when I write, even if I write nothing. You know, it's like if I was born to be a doctor, you know, I might have a really terrible day and maybe one of my patients would die and it would be awful, or I would make a mistake. But at the end of the day, I still kind of lived up to my life that day, you know, in the role that I'm destined to live. And, you know, and speaking of destiny, I see, I can't speak for anybody else's work, but I see my work as kind of destined organisms. I don't believe that my writer's block, I hate that term. I don't believe that it's, I experience trouble because I'm failing. If I'm struggling with a work, which I do all the time, it's usually because I need to live through that struggle in this eerie way that is going to tell me exactly what I need to do with the book. It's not like I'm going to be so smart about it and figure it out and be like, Eureka. I know now. I believe that like writing is this weird, murky space between inspiration and like the noise of consciousness. It's sort of between what we like the delusion. Okay, no, I should say it's between God and the delusion of free will, and it occurs in the tension between those two poles. Like, that's where I think creation happens. That's where art happens for me. And there is joy in that, but it's also, it can also be extremely painful to discover something painful.
Right.
You know, the book that I'm writing now has been, it's a novel. This has been the weirdest process of my life so far. It has taken me to places that I really, really didn't feel like going. And it's been crazy for me, crazy making and, you know, stressful. But that's what life is like sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
So the idea that things need to be easy for them to be pleasurable, like, yeah, okay, I get that. Like, who doesn't want to be, who doesn't want to feel good all the time? But I don't know. I think writers like to complain because writing is a lonely process and nobody can help you.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the big lie that the MFA industry is telling all these kids who, you know, love writing and love books and want to be writers is like, there's hope for you out there. It's not true.
Right.
You're alone with your mind and the paper. Like, yeah, sure, maybe you can get feedback and it'll, like, make some things click in your head. But, you know, it's a tough process.
Give us 50 grand and we'll solve your problems, right? Right.
Yeah. But there is a deep satisfaction in that struggle because ultimately it's the struggle with yourself, you know, and in through writing, if you're like really asking yourself deep questions, why am I doing this? Why am I doing it this way? Do I care? Who am I trying to please?
Right.
You know, and right. If the answer to the question, who am I trying to please, is anything stupid, you know, quit. Like, if you're trying to please your mom, you know, like, oh, your writing is going to make yourself miserable.
Or
you know,
penguin.
If you're trying to please
yeah.
the establishment or your professor,
yeah.
of course you're going to have writer's block.
Right.
You know?
You use the right word. I think joy and enthusiasm might have been the wrong word, but satisfaction, I think, is the right word, that you derive great satisfaction from the process
yeah.
and from learning whatever you learn. And I did read somewhere that the novel that you're working on now makes Eileen look like, you know, a day at Disneyland. And so, but going into the dark and into those, it's not joyful, but it probably is intensely satisfying and kind of traversing ground that other people haven't traversed yet and you know, being brave, all of those things are deeply satisfying. And I do think you can only do that process for yourself. You can't be pleasing anybody else while you're trying to lead a satisfying life.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've definitely made those mistakes and gotten burned, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, I should also say that A writer also has, like, freedom to choose what she wants to write about, you know. While I'm writing this really heavy new book, which in the end will be funny, because one of the things about me I realized is when I take myself seriously, it turns into satire automatically. Because so everything, I mean, I'm kind of an absurdist. Like, everything is just kind of absurd. Especially the depths of my despair. But on the side, I've started writing this comedy. Just like when I need a break from the depths of despair, I'm going into this comedy that's just totally ridiculous. And, you know, I think that that's kind of like a healthy way to approach things. You know, it's like if you're really depressed, you might look at pictures of, like, cute kittens on the internet, you know?
Right.
That has its value, too.
Well, and I don't think comedy and tragedy are as far separated as, you know, I think there's a close connection there. So it's, that makes sense. It makes sense. We've drawn down on our time, but is there one sentence word of advice that we should have given to our listening audience, writing listening audience, that we didn't?
Pray.
I like that. I like that.
Yeah.
This was great.
Writing, right? Yeah.
This was.
Yeah. Writing is an act of faith in many ways. So pray your butt off.
I love it. Otessa, this was wonderful. Thank you so much.
It was great to talk to you. Thanks for everything.
Yeah, that was Otessa Moshfegh. The book is Eileen. It is out in paperback now, and like I said, was just longlisted for the Man Booker. That's all the time we have for today. We'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.